Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Have you ever wondered if it's possible to teach a monkey how to floss its teeth? Or whether or not the group behavior of cows resembles that of an oscillator? Or if there's mathematical proof of the divine? Bet you have.
And even if you haven't, somewhere out there, a researcher has indeed asked those questions and published papers about them in highly respected academic journals. Why they do it, that's another question entirely.
But it is a question that's long fascinated Mark Abrams. And in the grand taxonomy of scientific inquiry, Abrams is the king cataloger of the branch he calls improbable research. He's founder of the Cambridge-based Annals of Improbable Research, creator and master of ceremonies of the Ig Nobel Prize, author of many books with suitably improbable titles such as Why Chickens Prefer Beautiful Humans, and This is Improbable, and his latest, This is Improbable Too, Synchronized Cows, Speedy Brain Extractors, and More WTF Research, where the grand unifying theory is this. The research Abrams writes about has to first make you laugh and then think. So let's do some laughing and thinking, because Mark Abrams joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me over here.
Well, it's great to have you. So I'd like to, we're going to talk about some of the research in just a second, but take me into the why your, as I called it, your grand unifying theory is research that has to make you laugh first and then think. Why is that the order of operations here?
Because that's what appeals to me. It's always appealed to me since I was a little kid. I really enjoy finding or hearing about things that are surprising, that are much different than I expected. This double thing, though, I've been doing this more or less professionally for about 25 years now. This first, it makes you laugh. That means it's got your attention. If it's going to make you laugh, a lot of the time that's because it's so far outside what you ever come across that your only possible reaction is to laugh. But once you're doing that, you're paying attention. So that's the think.
Absolutely. Well, I have to say, in reading through the book today, we haven't been able to stop thinking about the whys and the whos behind all this research. So let's talk about some of the research that you write about in This is Improbable Too. There are just so many to pick from, so let me just pick a couple. These were two that had that were related. For example, you write about how a man named Stephen Unwin, who's a theoretical physicist, wrote a paper about the probability of God when he found that there's a 67% probability that God exists. So tell us a little bit more about Stephen Unwin.
People who like to work with numbers, people who like to do calculations, sometimes fall so in love with the calculations that it's like falling in love, deeply in love with a person. You look at that person and you see a lot of things that nobody else can see. That apparently is what happened with Unwin. When you write an equation, it's just writing a description of something. It's like writing a sentence. It's like saying a sentence. And it's as good a description, you know, as accurate as a sentence would be. You describe, you know, the man who's walking there across the way. Maybe it's accurate, maybe it's not. So maybe his equation is accurate if it's not. If it's accurate, though, now he's the only one who thinks it is, but if it is, then he's describing how likely it is that God exists.
I appreciated the fact that he was a scientist through and through, because he also included the 5% chance that his calculation is wrong as well. And I should say that he even provides, what, the detailed instructions for the Microsoft Excel spreadsheet that he used to construct his probability?
Yeah, he's a rather obsessive person by the look of it.
Yeah, and he said, and there's a part of his story that you quote, I think him as writing, you are now a mathematical theologist and can do things which Aristotle, St. Thomas, and Kant only dreamed of. Please proceed responsibly. So on the other hand, there's a man named Robert W. Fade or Faid, mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure if which pronouncer is right. But he puzzled out the identity of the Antichrist through mathematics, even though, as you write, no one knew that the identity of the Antichrist was even a mathematical problem. So who is this guy?
Apparently he did. He's an engineer. He lives somewhere in the South. I've forgotten which state. He published a whole book about this. His explanation is long. It's several hundred pages. He wrote down some calculations, and if those are good descriptions, then he calculated the exact probability that Mikhail Gorbachev is the Antichrist. This was about 20 years ago when Gorbachev was still in office.
And that's his answer. And he has the exact probability.
Yeah, and it's very detailed.
Well, so, I mean, this leads us to one of the first of many questions about the nature of this research, because these are mostly papers that have actually been published in very scholarly journals. So I suppose in its broadest definition, all questions, all well-constructed questions deserve a bit of research. But I imagine a lot of people are asking, why even pursue the question of if there's mathematical proof of, say, the Antichrist?
I'd say that's an excellent question you're raising there. There are people called scientists. You know some, I'm sure. Many people listening know them. Scientists have a really strange and frustrating job. Somebody is asking them to make sense of things that nobody else was able to make sense of. All right, that's a very difficult job. They're probably going to fail most of the time. But if they keep at it, and if they're good, and if they're lucky, once in a while they might figure out something nobody managed to. If they do, it's probably going to sound really screwy at first. Now, it might be that it turns out to be quite true and maybe even useful. And if that's the case, later on, everybody will think it's just ordinary. Nobody will laugh at it. Nobody thinks it's screwy. But when it's new, it's really unexpected.
Hmm. I mean, I can imagine that there are many scientific laws or generally accepted theories now that sound completely normal, that if we sort of put our heads back in the time where they were first proposed or written about, you know, might have been in a book of this is improbable as well.
True. You and I are sitting here about 4 feet from each other talking to each other. I believe, and maybe you believe, that there are lots of people in other places miles and miles away who are hearing what we're saying. There's this radio wave stuff that you and I believe is carrying the sound to them. But, you know, who are we?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking also in addition to that of, say, the description of base pairs and how that lends itself to all life through DNA, or the fact that Einstein, and you write about other Einsteins in the book, you know, even had the audacity to think that he could come up with an equation that describes how energy and matter, one converts into the other.
I mean, yeah, and scientists like to fight each other. They like to be really skeptical. And their general attitude, the good ones, most of them are pretty good, their general attitude is, you think you found that? All right, prove it to me. Show me. I'm going to try to kick you in the knee and do anything I can to show that you're wrong, but prove it to me.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, in the proof, some of just the sheer titles of some of these papers are, I have to say, they are endlessly entertaining. For example, there was a 2012 paper published by a trio, I believe, of British researchers who got their hands on data from the British Bankers Association about bank robberies, and their study was called "Robbing Banks: Crime Does Pay, But Not Very Much."
Yeah, it seems nobody had really bothered, I guess, to go to all the trouble to figure out, does crime pay? And it was tough to get that information. Banks don't like to talk about how they were robbed or how much was taken or any of that. But this guy did manage to get the information from the banks and from the criminal justice system. And he did what an accountant does. He just calculated how much time, how much money did they get, how much income did they lose when they were in prison. And when you add all of that up meticulously, he found that robbing banks is a really crummy job. It's, I think, a little less than minimum wage.
They say that the average financial return on classical bank robbing, mind you, I suppose not of the more high-tech kind we might be more familiar with today, is, quote, a very modest £12,706.60 per person per raid, and that the industrious robber, as you write, can expect to work steadily at the trade for only about a year and a half before being caught and canned.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
the calculation is really kind of fun, even if you don't like equations and math to look at the detail of, well, let's see, every time you add one more accomplice, this is what it does to our take. So our haul goes down. But on the other hand, our chances of succeeding go up. And then, you know, he adds in all these little things and accounts for them.
There's also another one that I want to talk about, but actually it's more about the person rather than the research, because he pops up a lot in the book, This is Improbable Too. And that is a New York professor by the name of John Trinkaus.
Did I Trinkaus say Trinkaus is Trinkaus. How he pronounced it. I know how he pronounced it because I've gotten to know him well. We've become very friendly. He's in his 80s now. He's now a retired business school professor from New York City. When he was about 40 or so, he finally started doing something that he has continued ever since. He gets annoyed. He's one of those people who gets annoyed at lots of stuff. And one day he got annoyed at something, and rather than sit there and blow up, he decided he would count how many times this thing happens. So he would sit there for about 3 hours usually and count. How many times does somebody walk by doing this? And how many times does somebody walk by not doing this? They tended to be really ordinary kinds of things. One of them was at a street corner near his house. He got annoyed because he noticed that sometimes people will drive up, they see the stop sign, but they don't completely stop. So he sat there for 3 hours and he counted all the cars that came up to that stop sign.
Was the counting to justify his annoyance? Because he found that
it's
happening
justifying.
A lot.
I don't think he thought through exactly why he was doing it. He just decided to do it. And he felt better afterwards. He wrote it down. He sent it into one of the many academic journals and they published it. It's short. It's 2 or 3 pages. He doesn't try to explain anything about what it means or even if it means anything. A few years later, he was getting annoyed again. So he went back to the same corner, sat down for 3 hours again, counted again, discovered that the situation had gotten worse. Fewer people come to a complete stop. A few years later, he was annoyed again. He went back, did it again. He ended up doing 5 of these reports over many years. Every time he did it, he found the world's going to hell. People are behaving worse. And there are many other things like that he ended up doing a series of. One is in a church that I guess he goes to. It's a church where they sell candles, or they have candles you can buy, and it's all on the honor system. You can put a dollar or something in a box and take a candle. He noticed some people pay for it, but some people don't pay for that candle. So he sat there for about 3 hours, and he counted of the people who are taking a candle, how many leave money and how many don't. He published his little report. Then he went back a couple years later, counted again, discovered here too, the world's going to hell. Fewer people are paying for their candles. He did this with many, many things.
Okay, so I have to come back to the premise that we're to laugh first, then think. Because what are we to think about, you know, this kind of research in particular? Because, I don't know, I come from a family of scientists and love them all. But what you're talking... Actually, I do, yeah. Yeah, at least the ones in my family. But
we'll talk later.
But I was wondering, I mean, this to me, counting things that, or, you know, cataloging bad behavior falls into the realm of the science of the obvious or the science of common sense.
Yeah. Why is always a question that leads to good discussion. And for me personally, as a person who gathers this stuff, writes about it, puts on the Ig Nobel Prize ceremony every year where we give prizes to some of the most eye-catching things like this, to me, it starts and ends with this thing. If it makes people laugh, if it has that degree of whatever that's funny, and if it gets in people's heads enough that it's going to stay there and they keep thinking about it for a week, that's the beginning and the end. In a real way, I don't care what people think. It's important to me. I don't know why, but it's important to me that people start thinking about the things they pay attention to. And it's also important to me that they get to make their own decision about whether this thing is good or bad or important or not. That's one of the, I hope, themes underneath most of the stuff I do, the idea that, look at this stuff. It's surprising. Nobody's quite told you what to think about it, whether it's good or bad. You can make up your own mind. And you know what? You can make up your own mind on anything. You hear some important person telling you, that's evil or that's wonderful. You can accept it, but you can make up your own mind. You really don't have to just take somebody's word for it.
Well, I have made up my mind that one of the most interesting pieces of research that you write about in the book has to do with teaching monkeys how to floss their own teeth, a series of experiments that began in the 1970s by, a dentist named Jack Caton? Mm-hmm. Caton?
Caton, I believe, Caton. But I'm not sure either. I haven't met him.
So tell us about Jack Caton and why he decided to see if he could get monkeys to floss their own teeth.
He was really interested in flossing, not so much in monkeys. I guess it was easier for him to experiment with monkeys than to persuade
people. Than small children or even adults.
The thing that he seemed most interested in was the question, how often should somebody floss? You know, he's a professional modern dentist, so he knows everybody should floss. But how often? Should you do it every day? Should you do it a couple times a day? Is it okay if you skip a day? And he got some monkeys, and I think he did the flossing, or his assistant did. I'm not sure if he taught the monkeys. And what he discovered after a long time of this was that the monkeys that he flossed every day seemed to be no more or less healthy in their teeth, in their mouth, than the monkeys that he flossed every other day. So his big conclusion was it's probably okay for people, too, and monkeys, to floss every other day.
So that's really interesting to me, okay? Because when I read about this research, I was first thinking that here was a man who was interested in further understanding, you know, simian behavior, or, you know, to what extent can, for whatever it might help us understand, can monkeys be trained to adopt human types of behaviors, to understand, I don't know, monkeys?
No, I believe he was a classical dentist.
Yeah, so it was...
Teeth are first and foremost.
It had nothing to do with the monkeys at all.
But you don't have to be disappointed, because about 20 years later, somebody else in another part of the world heard about some monkeys in Thailand. And people there noticed that these monkeys would sometimes take hair from the heads of people who were there watching, tourists who'd come to see the monkeys. They would pluck a hair out of a person. And two of these monkeys had started to teach themselves, and not just started, they did. They were flossing their own teeth. And instead of dental floss, they were using long hair that they plucked from people's heads.
And they were doing this spontaneously.
They were doing this, yeah. It could be that one monkey taught the other. So in that case, there were some scientists who were very interested in monkeys and how do they learn things? How do they teach each other? Mm-hmm. And they then went so far as to give some of these monkeys some wigs of human hair. And they discovered that the monkeys liked plucking the hairs from the human wigs. The monkeys were using these wigs almost as dental floss dispensers.
Wow. I'm speaking with Mark Abrams. He's editor and co-founder of the Cambridge-based magazine, The Annals of Improbable Research. His new book is called This is Improbable, 2 Synchronized Cows, Speedy Brain Extractors, and More WTF Research. He's also the creator of the Ig Nobel Prize, which we'll talk about in just a minute. But I'm getting carried away in talking about all this really interesting research, and I should circle the conversation back to you, because I understand that when you were a young boy, what, about 10 years old, you had a scrapbook which mm-hmm. in which you were already collecting this kind of research or information?
Yep. I grew up not far from here. I was born in Newburyport, and when I was about 8, we moved to Swampscott, which is not far away from here. And I had an uncle who wrote for the newspaper in Newburyport. I always loved newspapers. I started reading them obsessively when I was a kid. And the paper there would often fill little spaces that I guess they had at the end of the day with news reports that had come in of just odd things. And those were the things I loved the most. And I just started cutting them out and pasting them in a scrapbook. The one that I remember the best is, I can even remember, I think, the shape of that on the page. The headline said something like, "Man flushes toilet, house blows up." When you're a 10-year-old boy.
What could be cooler?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So you had a passion for this stuff from the start, and then you went on to become the creator of the Ig Nobel Prize, which many of our listeners are probably already familiar with. But for those who aren't, tell us a little bit about what that is.
Yeah. I and a bunch of other people started this in 1991. The Ig Nobel Prize ceremony happens every fall. This year it's coming up on September 18th. We give prizes, 10 prizes every year, to people who have done things that first make people laugh and then make them think. Most of these are about science, but some of them are about other things. We often give a peace prize. We've given a prize in art. The man who invented who created the plastic pink flamingo won the Ig Nobel Prize in art. The winners are invited to come to the ceremony, which is at Harvard University, at their own expense. And almost all of them do. And when they get there, the theater, it's Sanders Theater, fits 1,100 people. It's always jammed to the gills. We have a bunch of Nobel Prize winners who are on stage, who shake the hands of these Ig Nobel winners and hand them their prizes. We write a little opera every year with real opera singers who sing this stuff. It's televised live on the internet. We were, I think, about the very first event of any kind 20 years ago to start webcasting things on the web.
And you get, what, thousands, 9,000 plus submissions from around the world?
We get these days about 9,000 or so new nominations every year for the Ig Nobel Prize. About 10 or 20% of those are people who nominate themselves, but they almost never win. It's really difficult to win one of these prizes if you are trying to.
Yeah. Well, my final question to you comes out of the of something we read in the Washington Post. That they wrote in a review that maybe one of the lessons to be drawn from your book is that, quote, you can't have world-changing discoveries without allowing apparently pointless research. And I think maybe the key word there is apparently. But would you agree?
Yeah, completely. I think people have noticed this in their own lives. Almost everybody has. But that's certainly true of science. Almost the whole history of science was somebody noticing or discovering something that seemed really, really unimportant and maybe even kind of stupid to everybody. And then it turned out this stupid, seemingly pointless thing, hey, it's kind of useful and it leads to a lot of other good things.
Well, Mark Abrams is the editor and co-founder of the Annals of Improbable Research. His new book is This is Improbable 2, Synchronized Cows, Speedy Brain Extractors, and More WTF Research. He'll be speaking at the Harvard Bookstore on Friday. There's more information about that at our website, radioboston.org. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Magna. This was a pleasure.
Well, stick with us. Coming up, you can order almost anything to arrive at your door through your smartphone. But could this delivery company boom end up as a bust? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.